What is up, Vermont Edition podcast listener? This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for VPR. Just to let you know, this podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The U.S. House late yesterday voted to impeach President Donald Trump for incitement of an insurrection. The charge refers to the president's role in inciting a mob riot of his most extreme supporters to take over the Capitol building last week. Five people were killed in that riot, including a member of the Capitol Police Department. Speaking on the House floor during the impeachment debate yesterday, Congressman Peter Welch urged his colleagues to remove President Trump from office.
If we want unity, we must have accountability. So the question before this Congress, will Congress condone through acquiescence or condemn through impeachment Donald Trump's violent acts to overturn the election?
Gentlemen,
Congress
time has expired. Gentlemen from Massachusetts,
I yield back.
Well, what happens next? Does it make sense to pursue this impeachment motion after the president has left office? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today at the top of the program, and that is Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
And we really appreciate your being available all week to keep us informed of what's happening in Washington. Let me start, Representative Welch. There are 6 days left in the four-year term of the office of President Trump. Some listeners might be wondering, why follow through with impeachment when the president will be out of office and a private citizen in less than a week?
You know, if you don't have accountability, we won't get to unity. This impeachment has to be completed, but it has to be completed very, very quickly. This was astonishing. Literally, the president assembled the mob, incited the mob, and had them march forward and overtake the Capitol. People got killed, and it was in pursuit of his effort to overturn a valid election. You can't ignore the fact of that happening, even if the timing was on his way out the door. So there's two issues here. There's accountability, and I think that's absolutely essential. And there's getting Biden off to a very quick and positive start where he focuses on COVID and economic recovery. So this impeachment has to be done, but it has to be done extremely quickly as we did in the House. And it's not as though you need a lot of evidence because the whole world watched the attack on the Capitol.
You mentioned accountability. I'm wondering, are you also concerned that the president might do something irrational or perhaps dangerous in the next week?
Well, he just did something dangerous. I mean, this is an astonishing, astonishing thing to have the president of the United States really inciting people to come to Washington and then giving an incendiary speech where folks in front of him were holding signs saying, "Hang Mike Pence." And then for him to decry his own vice president because Vice President Pence was refusing to basically unilaterally try to do something that he had no authority to do, and that is overturn the election. So, you know, some people are saying it's late in the term, and it is late in the term. But one question, why didn't Donald Trump stop doing impeachable acts long ago? So do we ignore it? You can't really. People died. The citadel of our democracy was attacked. The goal of the president was to overturn an election. No president in our history has ever done what he did. So he promoted this with a big lie about an illegal election or unfair election, no basis for it, and he employed violence as a political tactic. And there is absolutely no place in our democracy for violence to be the means of persuasion.
Congressman Welch, you talked about the need to have some unity so that the first 100 days of President-elect Joe Biden's administration can be getting some important things done. But can you do that at the same time that the Senate is holding an impeachment trial?
Frankly, you're right, Bob. That's a very, very difficult challenge. But you can't just ignore that we had this attack by a mob, armed mob, by the way, on the Capitol, and say, you know what, that was yesterday, let's move on. That is a searing experience in our democracy, so there has to be accountability. But the point I'm making is that it has to be done very, very quickly, and that can be done quickly. This is not like there has to be depositions and witnesses and hearings. This is something where the members of the Senate can look at the tapes, have a debate, and vote, and that's the way it should proceed. Vice President Biden, soon to be President Biden, has also asked whether there can be a bifurcation so that the Senate could act on his appointees, his cabinet appointees, in the morning and do the trial in the afternoon. So it's doable, but I think to ignore the reality of what happened, where lives were lost, where violence was used, where there was an armed effort to invade the Capitol to stop the certification of the electoral votes of the people of this country, you can't ignore that. So there's got to be accountability. It's got to be fast.
The impeachment resolution accuses the president of inciting an insurrection. Do you find him guilty of this charge based solely on the comments that he made to that mob of his extreme supporters last week? Or is it more than that? Is it a combination of factors?
It's more than that. I mean, from before the votes were cast, Donald Trump was saying it was going to be a rigged election. So he was beginning the process of the foundation of his lie about the election. And then from the moment the votes were counted and he lost, he promoted the lie that it was an unfair election. There's no evidence for that. 59 of the 60 lawsuits he filed were thrown out. Republican secretaries of state hand counted, as in Georgia, and they certified that the election was free and fair. There's no evidence for it. But he used the bully pulpit and he used social media to convince a lot of his supporters that it was bogus. So, and he then invited them to come to the Capitol on the 6th, January 6th, because he wanted them, in order to, quote, do the right thing and have the Congress stop certification of the election. So he invited the mob to the Capitol, and then he gave a speech and sent them on a mission to march on the Capitol, invade the Capitol, and go after Mike Pence and stop the certification. So this was a planned and execution of a plan that was in plain sight from actually before the November election, and then it was remitting and constant since the election.
Let's go to our callers and start with Robert, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Hi, Congressman. I don't know if you remember, but the last time you were on the radio, I called and I said January 6th was going to be a problem, and I think you agreed with me, and it was even worse than I thought. There is no bottom to this. No matter how bad we think it is, it always gets worse. So I'm calling about Mo Brooks. Can you get that guy expelled from Congress? That guy is as guilty as Trump is.
Well, I agree with
so,
that. In fact,
Congressman Welch, let's explain. Alabama Representative Mo Brooks was also at that rally before the mob stormed the Capitol building last Wednesday and made some very strong remarks.
Well, he made very strong remarks and was very supportive of the invasion of the Capitol. And also there's some indication in this investigation underway that Brooks and some other members of Congress were actually assisting some of the insurrectionists by escorting them around the Capitol to do reconnaissance. We don't know the facts on that, but that has to be investigated. A member of Congress can say and assert what they want. They can't lead an insurrection. They can't assist people who are going to invade the Capitol to do reconnaissance on the day before. So there is no reservation on my part that if some of this evidence that is out there is confirmed, that Mo Brooks and others who did things that he did should be expelled from Congress.
I'm wondering, Congressman, if we can break this into two categories. One, there'd be people like Representative Brooks who spoke at that rally and said that they wanted folks to go to the Capitol and take some definite action. I can't quite say what he said on the air. So that's one group. The other group is, did some Republican members, and this is maybe what you're alluding to, give some of the protesters the layout of the Capitol building and conspired with them so that they would know where to go on the day of the riots? Are those two different groups?
They are two different groups. It's two different acts. I mean, Brooks was doing the inciting with the president, speaking as aggressively as he was. But there is indication that some members of Congress who were aligned with some of the far right folks who have been promoting this invasion actually provided them with escorts and tours of the Capitol. And that can only be done right now, by the way, with a member of Congress. The usual tours that are available just by calling, say, my office and are done in the normal course have been they've been canceled really since COVID. So now the only way you can get through Congress is with a member of Congress who escorts you. And there's some indication that some members did that. That's going to be under investigation. Abigail Spanberger, my colleague from New Jersey, a naval, U.S. Naval Academy, a graduate and military person, has authored a letter asking for that investigation on the basis of what we have. But that's illegal. And that's grounds for expulsion if a member of Congress is doing that. And I don't care whether it's a Democrat or Republican.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Dan in Colchester. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. And thank you, Congressman Welch, for your vote to impeach yesterday.
Thank you.
Can you guys hear me?
Yep, we're good.
We sure can.
So this is what I would like to hear you pontificate about just very briefly, Congressman.
I don't like to pontificate about anything. I'll give you an opinion.
Well, I heard a lot of rebuttal on the floor yesterday making the false equivalency between the insurrection at the Capitol and the Black Lives Matter protests, some of which did unfortunately cause some damage and become somewhat violent. I don't think the Democrats rebutted that very effectively, even though it's pretty obvious that it shouldn't need to be rebutted. But would you do a bit of that right now?
Well, look, my view is that violence is inappropriate anywhere, you know, in any kind of demonstration. I was involved in a lot of demonstrations in the civil rights movement, and there's always a danger of violence and you don't want it. But whatever the cause, whatever the objective of the political point of view you're advocating, violence should be off the table, all right? What's so different about this is that you have the president of the United States inciting the crowd. He assembled the crowd. He gave the crowd their mission, go down to the Capitol. They walked down there, marched down there with Hang Mike Pence signs. I saw them on the mall when I took a walk down to the Lincoln Memorial in the morning, practicing military-style marching. Now, I didn't think much of it at the moment. But, of course, fast forward, a couple of hours later, the president gives them that speech, and they actually use that formation to overtake an understaffed Capitol Police force. So the violence anywhere is wrong. It's wrong. It is not a legitimate tool of political persuasion. But where you have something that's so extraordinary is that it's the president of the United States who resorted to encouraging people to do something violent, invade the Capitol, and serve his goal of trying to overturn a legitimate election. That's what's so extraordinary about this. So there's nothing to compare. There's something to judge here. Did this president do something that's impeachable? And there's nothing I can imagine that would be more impeachable than what he did.
Dan, thanks for your phone call. Let's turn to Mike in Barrie. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, and Congressman Welch, happy to have your ear.
Thank you.
I guess my comments are going to be somewhat along the same lines of the last caller. I guess what I see as an American, and I think a lot of Americans do, is, you know, I guess I understand your point. I certainly don't condone what happened at the Capitol, and I understand your point in regards to the president and how that makes it different, but as there were riots and protests going on all throughout the summer, there was a lot of cases where high-ranking members of government in the Congress, the Senate, even a candidate for vice president were encouraging those riots to continue after they had turned violent. So I think what we should be seeing is more accountability across the board.
Well, see, I am for accountability, okay? I don't know which specific ones you're talking about, but I can't make it any clearer than what I just said. Violence is an illegitimate tactic, and I don't care what the goal is. Whether it's Black Lives Matter or the president trying to reverse an election, violence is not an appropriate tactic. So I can say right here, I'm against it. I'm against the use of violence to get your way, whatever your way is. But it's not a defense to what the president did, and this is the responsibility we have in Congress to hold him accountable. It's not a defense for what the president did for my Republican colleagues to pick and choose other incidents where something happened that may be objectionable. We have actually a responsibility. If there's going to be any accountability, it has to be from the House of Representatives that has the authority, and we're the only ones that have authority to file articles of impeachment. So the question for my colleagues, which they dodged by essentially trying to change the subject, was, did the president do something that was impeachable? And the fact that somebody else somewhere at some time did something that was wrong is not a defense to what Donald Trump did. And by the way, politicians, presidents, they should be held to a standard that is higher. This is the president of the United States who has enormous authority, and where his fundamental responsibility with his oath of office is to uphold the law, to not break the law. So this is something, and the use of violence is a tactic that is unprecedented in our history, certainly in my lifetime.
Let's see if we can get a quick call in from Eric in Hardwick. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks very much. Representative Welch, it was as shocking as it was to see the attack on the Capitol. It's even more shocking to me to learn that we have the same kind of extremist problem that's growing up here in Vermont. These people who attacked the Capitol didn't come out of nowhere. They grow and they train and they congregate in different places. And I'm talking specifically about the Slate Ridge Reservation in West Paulette. Do you know of this place, and are you aware of the incredible foot-dragging that's going on among our state officials in doing anything about this place?
Well, I know what I've read, but not enough to be specifically responsive to what's going on there. But your point is one I agree with. You know, Trump is going to be gone in a few days. Trumpism will not be gone. I mean, the combination of what Trump did, he didn't create these circumstances on the far right, on the use of violence, on the conspiracy theories, but he has kind of a feral genius about how to stoke that and how to use that politics of division, the politics of conspiracy theories, as a way to, for him, get power and then to solidify his base. But we've got ongoing challenges to deal with a politics where people are making up facts, believing in conspiracies, and we're not having the dialogue that you need to resolve really challenging issues that this country faces. And, of course, this has all been amplified by social media and their algorithms that are all intended to provoke engagement, and that usually is triggered more with anger so that they can sell more advertising. So these are dynamics that are out there that Trump exploited, but I continue even after Trump is gone and Joe Biden is sworn in. You know, we're fortunate in Vermont because there is a tradition of our town meeting, but we've got to hang on to that. And, you know, you see even with our governor who condemned the Trump action because of the behavior. There was no hesitation on his part on the basis of party loyalty when you had a president who was inciting violence. But that's special about Vermont. But each one of us has to do every single thing we can to maintain that civic sense of participation and tolerance.
Eric, thanks for your phone call. I want our listeners to know that we've got some really great recent reporting by VPR's Nina Keck and Pete Hirschfeld, all about the situation at Slate Ridge, a two-part series that you can see at vpr.org. If you're interested in that subject, in that issue, Nina Keck and Pete Hirschfeld did some fabulous reporting of what's happening down there. Congressman, I know we have to let you go in just a moment. Next week, we have the inauguration of the new president. Will you be there, and will you feel safe?
Well, I'm planning on being there, and I'll definitely feel safe. I mean, I'm actually sad about this, Bob. You know, the day after the invasion, they began putting up this huge security fence for the inauguration. Had they done that a day before, then we wouldn't have had any of this problem. When I left Washington yesterday, they had several of these huge security fences up. The National Guard literally was sleeping in the Capitol. When I walked to the Capitol, I was walking around these exhausted National Guards people who had been up all night and were sleeping on the marble floor. We now have more troops in the Capitol than we have in Afghanistan. And I'm sad about that. I'm really sad about it. So I am not concerned about safety. I am concerned about a kind of democracy where the wonderful event of the peaceful transition of power, not so peaceful this time, but where we're going to have a new president because the American people elected a new president, that person is going to take the oath of office, that we can't have that be a purely joyous occasion. And even if it wasn't the candidate we wanted, we celebrate the American value of the peaceful transition of power and that the voters decide who their leader is.
Congressman Peter Welch, many thanks for taking the time to be with us today, and thanks again for your availability all week as we cover this important story.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to let Vermonters know what's going on. I know there's an immense amount of interest. Thank you.
The U.S. House yesterday voted to impeach President Trump for inciting an insurrection against the U.S. government when he spoke to a mob of his extreme supporters just before they stormed the Capitol building last week. What is the significance of this impeachment motion, and why do some Democrats favor continuing with the impeachment process after the president has left office, as we just heard from Congressman Peter Welch? Well, joining us now to discuss these and other issues are Linda Fowler, a professor of government emerita at Dartmouth College. Linda, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Bob.
And also with us, Dante Scala, a political science professor at the University of New Hampshire. Dante, very glad to have you with us as well.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Linda, we spoke a week ago on this program following that mob riot at the Capitol building where five people were killed. Now it's a week later. Can you put the last 8 days into perspective for us? How do you think this time is going to be remembered?
Well, it is extraordinary. I was in the Capitol back in the bad old days when there were protests against the Vietnam War and the Washington Capitol was burning. You could see the flames in the city from the Capitol building because of riots after Martin Luther King's assassination. So certainly the Capitol is no stranger to violence. What's really remarkable about this is the extent to which elected officials, certainly the president and perhaps other members of Congress, appear to have instigated it. And more shockingly, once the violence had started, the delays of the president in calling for a cessation and authorizing National Guard troops to quell the rioters was, I think, the most shocking piece of it. The idea that he just sat for 4 hours and watched this unfold on television was the worst part for me.
And Linda, there are reports today of some Republican House members of assisting protesters in laying out the map of the Capitol, or perhaps adding to the incitement of the mob. How do you factor all that in?
Well, I think that's a big factor in the impeachment inquiry. I think Liz Cheney, a Republican and the third-ranked Republican leader, said it all when she said that more is going to come out, and therefore we'd better take the opportunity to preempt any activities by showing just how firmly the Congress is against this kind of activity. Unfortunately, so many members of Congress who should be standing up to defend their institution are afraid, seemingly, to do that. And that's the one of the big takeaways of the vote yesterday was how many people said what the president did was wrong, but I'm afraid to cast a vote for impeachment because of the safety of my family. That is just appalling. And so you get the sense that people really haven't accepted just how violent things were and how close we came to even more of a tragedy in terms of death and violence. And until that recognition really takes place, I think the impeachment is just sort of the first step in a long process. The country, we're a big, diverse, complex country, and it always takes a long time for the public to process major events like this. And I think we're certainly, impeachment is not the end of this. And even if the Senate had voted, you know, had taken up the case right away and had even voted to convict Trump, that's not the end of it. There are too many moving parts that need to be understood.
Dante, how do you view the events of the last week in this country, and how do you place these events in perspective for your students?
You know, usually, Bob, teaching introduction to American politics to my students, you know, throughout my teaching career, and I'm 52, so I'm like halfway through my career, has been a pretty straightforward type of thing in which, you know, everyone, including my students, thinks they understand how things turn out in the end. And in other words, things turn out happily, right? There are problems, but we overcome them, and the system works as the founders intended, and, you know, there have been some glitches along the way and so forth. And now I think the next time I go into the classroom in, you know, say next fall, teaching Introduction to American Government, things will be very different. I mean, just because that thing we took for granted for so long, the peaceful transfer of power, really that norm was just obliterated over the past few months. So I think my students who, you know, were born in the 2000s and are going to be much more impressed with the fragility of American democracy than, you know, any previous generation of students that I've taught.
Well, let me just be the devil's advocate there with you and say, does it show the fragility of the American democratic system or the resiliency of that system that despite what happened last week, that our democratic form of government seems to still be working?
I take your point, and I always try to – I would like to think you're correct about resilience. I mean, and I think impeachment, no matter whether it results in conviction and perhaps ultimate, you know, expulsion of President Trump from American political life, regardless, I think we saw, you know, some version of the checks and balances – that we were all brought up to believe were a hallmark of the American political system in action. I think if the House had not impeached after all that happened, basically one branch of government would have been surrendering to the executive branch, which has only grown, you know, more and more powerful over the past, say, half century, way before Donald Trump took office. I mean, that was the real nightmare scenario, is that we created an executive that was very powerful, much more powerful, I would argue, than the American framers of the Constitution envisioned. And then we basically handed all that off to a person, you know, of such, you know, poor character and ignorance of the American system. and said, oh, go at it, right? But we did see some evidence of checks and balances. I just, what has impressed me over the last few years is how much our American constitutional system and our political system depend on an implicit set of norms of behavior that are not written into law, but nonetheless we depend on. And one of those is as simple as the loser of an election conceding to the winner. I mean, that's not written down in the Constitution or in law, but that very omission by the president has been, you know, that's what led to all of these problems. And it's something the president still refuses to admit now. And we saw in the House debate yesterday that many, many House Republicans still hold to that.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Kai, who's calling from Montpelier. Hi, Kai. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bob. Nice to be here, and thank you to your panelists and for the show. I have two questions. One's quick and one's deep. The quick question is, and I think it was referenced a little bit, if more facts come forward before this goes to Senate, can those be included, for instance, if hypothetically it's shown that there was a concerted effort to avoid bringing more troops or police to the event and that the president or folks in the White House were behind that. Can that be introduced, so to speak, as evidence at the trial or once the resolution had passed the House? So that's a process question. The second question for the panelists and listeners who want to weigh in, I think I'm curious to understand how we get unity as a nation when perhaps a third or more of Americans truly believe that this was a fraudulent election. That seems like a fundamental problem in achieving unity going forward, and it's what keeps me up at night. Thank you.
Kai, those are two very good questions. Linda, let's start with you with the second question, which is how do we achieve unity when at least a third of the people in this country believe it was a fraudulent election?
Oh, you gave me the easy one, eh? I think this is why the short impeachment trial is potentially a problem. And I didn't see any way around it because right now the evidence, as your caller points out, the evidence hasn't really been developed yet. The articles that the Congress brought, that the House brought against the president are quite broad, inciting insurrection. And so presumably as the House managers bring evidence to the Senate, because they would be prosecuting the case, they would be able to show that, show more evidence than what was put forward yesterday. So the real question is how open is that third to hearing something different. And certainly the Republican lawmakers could do quite a bit to ease that, to make the transition easier for people who still believe. I guess in the end, for a lot of people who think they're Christian, have been persuaded that their Christian religion will be taken from them, that their guns will be taken from them, the other fears that have been stoked, to some extent, when that doesn't happen, because it's not going to happen, some of them maybe have their fears eased and will accept the outcome, what is terrifying for them, as they thought it was.
And Dante, let me follow up with a slightly different question. You know, there's been a lot of reporting about the 10 Republicans in the House yesterday who voted to impeach the president. There were 197 Republican members who voted not to support that impeachment resolution. Does that tell us that the president is still pretty popular within the Republican Party?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely it does. And it's a case right now. I mean, it's a really interesting political question now for Mitch McConnell, the Senate, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate and his fellow senators, about what to do about the Republican Party after the Trump presidency, because certainly we see there's an awful lot of pro-Trump sentiment, and the House, you know, the House is a good reflection of that, right? I mean, they obviously the House is more directly related to the people than the Senate, as we would expect. And so there's a lot of pro-Trump sentiment that hasn't gone away. And will the Republican senators take advantage of impeachment and conviction essentially to try to rip off the Band-Aid and to try to chart a path for their party without President Trump involved at all? And will they be willing to roll the dice on that, knowing that there will at least be some short-term pain and there would be outrage and cries of betrayal or by the base? And can they nonetheless, can the Republicans keep that base that Trump helped to build over the past several years going forward? I mean, that's, to me, is the key political question that underlies the legal questions, you know, surrounding what the Senate's going to do now with, you know, the House's impeachment. And just to mention about the shorter question, yeah, I don't see why, if more facts come forward over the next couple of weeks, why the Senate would not take those up. One, as Linda mentioned, right, the charges brought in the House impeachment were fairly broad. And second, remember that the Senate is, in effect, the, you know, they're the jury for Trump, but, you know, they're not sequestered, right? So even if, you know, the evidence, is going to be publicly known. And, you know, so far at least, all we've learned about what happened last week has only made it worse. What if that trend continues over the next couple of weeks? Then, you know, the situation surrounding what happened last week could look very different still than what we know right now.
Let's talk to Jim in West Burke. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two things to help frame your opinion of what should be done. Just imagine the president watching the attack on television, and who do you imagine he's rooting for? That should give you an idea what needs to be done. The second thing is I think the Democrats ought to give him one last opportunity to compromise, that if he actually admits that he lost the election, they'll call off the impeachment. If he wants to run in 2024, then he should act like a president and really admit that he lost the election. I guess that's all I have to say.
Okay, thanks very much, Jim. Dante, do you think there's anything that President Trump could say at this point that would delay or postpone the impeachment trial in the Senate?
I would agree with Jim that I think to some extent that if the president admitted that he lost the election fair and square, I think that would go a long way toward convincing the Senate that he should not be convicted and then, you know, basically exiled from political life. That said, I don't think that's going to happen ever. Right, I really doubt that the president ever will admit he lost fair and square, and I think that's central, really, to, you know, the whole question going forward is, you know, does the president represent a clear danger not just now in the next week, but, you know, he's not going away, right? I mean, why wouldn't the president be the nominee of the Republican Party in 2024? It's not a sure thing. But we certainly can't count it out as a possibility. And can the nation heal itself or begin to heal itself if there's that basically specter holding over the nation that the president could become the president again in just a few years?
Let's turn back to our callers and talk to Pete in St. Johnsbury. Hey, Pete, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just have a quick comment, and possibly your guests would respond. But it seems to me that one of the most compelling issues in our political morass that we're in with this gridlock is not just the manufactured facts and not just the exaggerations, but the ad hominem arguments that are engaged. People are attacking people and not their underlying ideas. And I see that coming really over the last 20 or 30 years from both sides of the aisle. And it is a recipe for just more and more gridlock. So I just wonder if there's a way to get people to change their habits.
Pete, that's a very good point. Can you think back on when you think this started, when all of a sudden, if somebody had a different point of view from someone's, that there was something wrong with that person? They were uneducated. They were immoral. It got to be a very personal attack on people who had different points of view, and the idea of trying to respect people and their points of view really went by the wayside. Do you have a sense of when that started?
Actually, as I'm thinking about it, I think it's a lot farther back than 20 or 30 years. But very clearly, I remember it in the Reagan administration. I remember it in the H.W. Bush administration. I remember it in the Clinton administration, the W. Bush. Certainly Obama, and certainly in Trump. And it has been from both sides of the aisle. The opponents, the president, whoever it was, or the other party, the attacks were very, very personal. And certainly, I think perhaps Donald Trump has taken it to a fine art form. But, you know, I think that this is something that has absolutely been a symptom of our current political discourse.
Pete, it's a great question. Linda, what are your thoughts about that? You've studied American history, American politics. When did it get so nasty?
Well, it was pretty nasty in the 60s, if you recall, when police were called pigs and returning Vietnam soldiers were called baby killers and all sorts of things. The difference then was that people, the radical left, which sounded pretty crazy sometimes, was not winning elective office, was certainly not holding the White House as a platform. So you can... We've always had violent rhetoric in our political history, but I would contrast what happened with the far left in the 60s and the anti-war movement with what's happening today, and that is it's being articulated and validated by elected officials, and I think for that you really have to point to Newt Gingrich. He was the one, as a member of Congress and then as Speaker, who basically was saying we have the whole system is rotten and corrupt. We have to tear it down. It can't be reformed. And that mindset has been animating the Republican Party ever since, I think. So a lot of my colleagues in political science would point to the election of Gingrich as Speaker in 1995. But we saw similar kinds of things with the Tea Party in 2010. I want to just add one thing. We keep talking about the Trump base, the Trump base, the Trump base. One thing I think we have to look at right now is that American corporations and businesses of all stripes have been repelled by what they've seen in the last week. And one thing that the Republican Party has to remember is that money comes from corporations, a big part of it, and wealthy donors. But the Republicans lost the presidential election in the suburbs. It wasn't black cities, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Detroit. The vote margins were no different in 2020 than they were in 2016 for those cities. Where the president lost his election was in suburban Atlanta, suburban Michigan, and so forth. And until Republicans acknowledge that they had a candidate who did, who turned off suburban voters, and that, of course, is why they managed to make inroads in the House and hold on to some marginal Senate seats. And that's profoundly political calculation that is not going to go away. And God forbid, if Trump were the candidate of the GOP in 2024, you'd see the same thing.
Dante, we're almost out of time, but in terms of people having political discourse, do you think the situation is exacerbated by cable news, people now getting their news primarily from sources that reinforce what they already believe?
You know, I think certainly you can look at, you know, social media doing a lot of that. But also, you know, I'm always, when, on the rare occasions I watch cable television for political news, I'm always struck by the fact that they often seem to me to be collaborators in the whole Donald Trump show. You know, even CNN, which I think Donald Trump often goes after, in some ways they've been collaborators with the president dating back to when he started running for office, in the sense that, you know, they, cable television news craves drama above all. You know, not delivering news, but delivering drama in order to get viewers. And we see social media platforms operating on the same way. And so, you know, we have to kind of think about how to fix that, too, in order to fix our politics.
Well, that's going to do it for our program today. Many thanks to our guests, Linda Fowler and Dante Scala. We thank you both very much for taking the time to be with us for this discussion today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.